We are starting a brand new section of Rambam. This is so awesome. This is the laws of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Sefer Torah. Chapter 1. This has 10 chapters, by the way, this section. So you can master all of the laws of how to make Tefillin, Mezuzah, Sefer Torah, and how to treat them in just 10 days, one chapter a day, half an hour a day. We're about to do that. Let's do it. Halacha 1, Introduction. Laws of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Sefer Torah, Introduction. They have, within these 10 chapters, 5 mitzvahs, positive mitzvahs, and they are, numero uno, to have Tefillin on your head. It's a mitzvah to have Tefillin on your head. Number 2, it's a mitzvah to bind Tefillin on your arm. Number 3, it's a mitzvah, positive mitzvah, to affix a mezuzah at the entrances of your gates. Number 4, it's a mitzvah for every man, every Jewish man, to write a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, for himself. Number 5, there is a mitzvah for the king, the Jewish king, to write a second additional Torah scroll for himself, so that he has 2 Torahs. And the explanation for all these mitzvahs will be in the following 10 chapters. Number 1. There are 4 places in the Torah where the Torah talks about the mitzvah of Tefillin. 2 of them are in Exodus, Parshas Bo, and 2 of them are in Deuteronomy. Those 4 sections, each of them is called a Parsha, not to be confused with the Parsha of the week, but Parsha as a section. Those 4 sections are, one is called Kadesh Li, the first words is Kadesh Li, sanctify for me. The second one is called V'hayaki V'yacha Hashem, and when God will bring you. Those are the words that introduce, those are the first words of these sections, these passages that contain the mitzvah of Tefillin. And so 2 of them are in Shemot, and 2 of them are in Deuteronomy. The 2 that are in Deuteronomy are the more famous ones, Shema Yisrael and V'hayem Shemoah. By the way, the 2 from Deuteronomy, those are the ones that are in the mezuzah. 2 sections, Shema, Vahavta, and Vahayim Shema. All 4, those you're going to find in your Tefillin. The reason for that is because those other 2 sections that talk about Tefillin in Exodus do not talk about mezuzah. So each of these sections is written independently. Then you wrap it in leather, covered in leather. And these are called Tefillin. That's the definition of Tefillin. You put them on your head and you bind them upon your arm. And it's very important that you've got every single word and every single letter. In words of Rambam, if there's even the mere point of one of the letters, so like for example a yud, we know what a yud looks like, but the way it's written in the holy things like a Torah, mezuzah, or Tefillin, there's a little line, a very thin line that's coming up, at the top of the yud. The koitzi shel yud is called. And if it's even missing that little point that's coming out of the yud, that from any one of these 4 sections, the entire thing is not kosher. And that's a Torah law, says the Rambam. That's not rabbinic, that's not a custom, that's not an extra stringency. That is straight up biblical requirement that every single portion has to be written 100%. It's like code, right? You know, if you're doing coding, it's like, oh, just missing one letter, no problem. Yeah, I got most of them, right? No, it doesn't work. So that's a good metaphor for Tefillin. Number 2, the same is true of the 2 parshas, the 2 sections that we have in the mezuzah, which is from Deuteronomy, Shema, Hear, O Israel, and Bahayim Shema, if you will listen. If you're missing even one letter from these 2 parshas, or missing even one point of one of the letters, that is going to invalidate your mezuzah. They both have to be written completely. And the same thing is true of the Torah scroll, that if it's missing even one letter, it will be invalid. Now here the Rambam seems to indicate that with the Torah scroll, it's a little bit more lenient because he doesn't talk about the point. He only talks about a complete letter. Commentators differ whether we should read too much into that or not. So we'll leave it at that. Number three, there are 10 things that the Tefillin require. And we know this as something that was passed down from Moses that he heard at Sinai from God. And all of these things are critical to the kashrut, to the validity of the Tefillin. There's 10. And therefore, if you made any deviation in any of these 10, the Tefillin are going to be pisulot, pasul. Pasul means invalid. 2 of these 10 relates to how it is written, b'ktivatan. 8 of them relates to how you wrap it in leather and how you tie the leather straps. And these are the 2 factors you need to keep in mind when writing the Tefillin. And that is, it has to be written with an ink known as Dio, as the Rambam will explain. And it has to be written upon parchment that is known as Klaf. Now the Rambam will explain what these 2 things are. Number 4. Ketzad ma'iseh ha-dioi. How is the Dio manufactured? Interesting that Dio and Dye, D-Y-E, are quite similar. And seems like they come from the same root. Kaptzin Oshins, how do you make the dio? How do you make the ink that is kosher for holy script? You gather the vapor of oils. I think it says that the best is to use olive oil. As we know, we love olive oil. Or of tar, or of wax, or the like. And you knead it together with sap from a tree and a little bit of honey. And then it moistens extensively. You let it soak, and you crush it until it's formed into flat cakes. Dry it out, and store it. And so you've got a powder. So when you're ready to use it, you soak it in gallnut juice. Sounds delicious, or the like, and you write with it. And what's unique about this type of ink is that if you will erase it, it can be erased. It's not it's permanent if you don't start scratching it off. But it's possible to rub it out. And this is the type of ink that is best to use, mitzvah min hamuvchar, to use for sefarim, tefillin, and mezuzot. When he says sefarim, he's talking about Torah scrolls, tefillin, and mezuzot. However, if you use a different type of dio, which is you made it from gallnut juice or vitriol, which is something that you cannot rub out, it is still acceptable. Number 5. So what does it mean? What was the Torah, when we say that it has to be done with dio, what exactly is the halacha from Moses, from Sinai, what is it excluding? Says the Rambam, it is excluding other colors. So when we say dio, we're talking about black ink. But if it's going to be red ink, adom, or yarok, which is green, and any other color, it's not going to be kosher. If you write Torah scrolls or tefillin or mezuzahs, even one letter, even if it's 99.9% black, but one letter is made with some other color, or even gold. You have the Trump Torah written in gold. We already had the Trump shofar, which we found out was not kosher. That's the shofar coated in gold. So one letter in gold, that will not be kosher. Sorry. Number 6, shalosh arot orotain. There's 3 different types of parchment, or literally is a hide, the 3 different types of parchment. Gvil, klaf, and dursustus. Gvil, klaf, and dursustus. And Rambam will now describe each of these 3 and say which one is best for which, for Torah, which is best for tefillin, which is both for mezuzah. And he says like this, take the hide of an animal or a beast, but kosher, as we'll see, it's got to be a kosher animal. And you remove the hair from the hide. That's the first thing. And then you salt it with salt. And then you prepare the skin with flour. And then with resin and other substances. Things that will make the hide contract and make it strong. That, once you've gone through that process, what you have in your hands is called gvil. Gvil, according to Rambam, the way he talks about it in other places, gvil is basically like a rough, unsmooth surface. So that's the gvil. If you then take the hide and you split it in half, you cut it into two pieces. Not down the middle, but you actually slice it and make it thinner. And you cut it in half along its width, along its depth, as the hide workers know how to do, the parchment processors know how to do. So you've got two hides. So one of them is going to be very thin, and that is on the side, on the external side. And one is going to be thicker, and that is on the flesh side. And you have processed it with salt, and then with flour, and then with the resin, etc. So the part that is opposite the hair, meaning the outer one is called the klaf, and the one that is closer to the flesh is called the dosustus. So now you know what all these three things are. Now he's going to tell you what is best. Number 8 says the Rambam, it's a halacha passed down from Moses, who we heard from Sinai, from God, that the best way to write the Torah scroll is to use the gvil and to write it on the external side of the parchment, the side of where the hair was of the animal. But when it comes to the tefillin, it's better to use the klaf, which is closer to the animal, the inside of the animal, and to write it on the side that is closer to the flesh, not the side that is closer to the external part of the animal. And the mezuzah is supposed to be written with the dosustus, and to write it on the side that is external. And anybody who writes on the klaf, where the hair used to be, or the side of the hair, or writes on the gvil or the dosustus on the side of the flesh towards the internal of the animal, it is going to be invalid. Says the Rambam, even though this is the halacha from Moses of Sinai, if you wrote a Torah scroll on klaf, it's still kosher. In other words, the tradition from Moses is that's the best way to do it. As he started off over here, mitzvah min amuvchar, that is the best way to do it. But it's not necessarily the only way to do it, and it can be written with the klaf. Now, this is a very interesting historical story and very relevant to today, because today the Torah scrolls, primarily, especially the Ashkenazic Jews, but also by the Sephardim as well, is written on the klaf. The klaf is the gvil is closer to the external part of the animal. The klaf is closer to the flesh of the animal. It's smoother. And what happened was that at some point it became more common to use a feather as your quill rather than a reed. That's what was happening in Europe. And so the sofers, the Jewish sofers in Europe, were adopting that as well. And they found that it was easier to write with the feather as opposed to a reed. And it was easier to write it on the klaf, which was smoother, rather than the gvil. And so that became the custom. And as you see, Rambam says it's kosher, and the Rama says it's kosher, it's fine. But the Yemenite Jews, they follow the Rambam. As we've seen in the past, the Yemenite Jews really loved the Rambam. He was a teacher for them. And so if he says it's supposed to be with the gvil, they stick with that. And so to this day, in the Yemenite tradition, the Torahs that are Yemenite, they have a thicker, darker parchment, you can see, because they're using the gvil and not the klaf. And apparently some Sephardic traditions are also leaning towards using the gvil. But in Ashkenaz, it's almost always going to be the whiter klaf. So what does he say? Halacha l'mashem sinai is that if you write on the that you should do it on the gvil, but if you write it on the cloth, it's still kosher. L'nemar gvil l'mayitos tusas. And what the halacha from Moses from Sinai is excluding the dustus that if you wrote a Torah scroll on dustus that it's not going to be kosher. And also if you wrote a mezuzah on cloth or on gvil, it's going to be kosher. And the idea that it should be written on dustus is only a ideal way to do it, but it's not critical. Number 10, ein kosvin sefarim tefillin mezuzah yisal gabi or behema. At the end, I'll show you, I pull up a website that has some pictures of the different parchments, and I'll show you the pictures. Okay, so the parchment has to be made from animals, the hide of animals that are kosher. You cannot make it from a non-kosher animal or a non-kosher bird or a non-kosher wild animal. But it can be written on the hide of a domesticated animal or a wild animal that is kosher, and also a bird that is kosher. And here's something that you might not have thought of. What if the animal was not slaughtered properly and he can't eat the meat? Can you still use the hide for writing of a Torah scroll, etc.? The answer is yes. As long as the animal is kosher, it doesn't have to be that the meat itself is kosher to eat. So even if it's a, nivela, meaning that it wasn't slaughtered properly, it died or it was killed in some way other than a kosher slaughter, it's still going to be kosher to use the hide for parchment. Or trefa, let's say it was an animal that is not kosher because it has some wound or illness that would make it die within a year, that would be unkosher to eat, even if it was slaughtered properly, it's called trefa. But it would still be kosher for writing of the Holy Scripts. Now, he says, you cannot write upon the hide of a kosher fish because of the foul secretions. Imagine the guy who comes to shul with the fish, the fish parchment. Everybody knows he walked into shul. You can smell it. So we're not supposed to do it because the smell will not cease. Even if you process the fish hide and make leather out of it, make parchment out of it, it's theoretically you could write on it and it would be kosher. That's what the Rambam is implying. But because it has this foul smell, it's not a good idea and it should not allowed to be done. I was wondering, if scientifically we figure out a way to remove the odor from the fish, would it then be kosher to have a parchment written on fish, the fish parchment? Interesting. Okay, number 11, I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. Number 11, gvil shel sefer Torah, let's say you have the gvil of a Torah scroll, or a cloth of a tefillin, or of a Torah scroll, these all have to be processed with the intention, the person processing the hide and turning it into parchment has to do so with intentionality, with kavanah. And it's called lishma, for the sake of what? That I'm making this parchment so that it can be used for a Torah scroll. I'm making this parchment so that it can be used for a tefillin. If it's not, that doesn't happen, and the person's just doing it because he wants to earn a living, or he doesn't know what's going to happen with this leather, with this parchment. Psulin, they are not kosher. And the tefillin written on those parchments are no good. Fichach, therefore, if you have a non-Jew who is the one processing the hide, even if you told the non-Jew, this hide we've asked you to process, this is for a Torah scroll or this is for tefillin, it's still not going to be valid. Why? Because the non-Jew, why is he doing it? He's not doing it for the tefillin. He's not doing it for the Torah. He's doing it so he can get paid, go home and pay his rent or mortgage, etc. Therefore, but a Jew who has a mitzvah to make Torah scrolls, has a mitzvah to do tefillin, when you tell him this is what he's doing, even if he's getting paid, he's able to say that he's doing this for the sake of Torah, doing this for the sake of tefillin, making tefillin. Therefore, Rambam now gives us a general rule beyond Torah scrolls, tefillin. Any time something has to be done for the sake, if something has to be prepared or manufactured, for the sake of a mitzvah, it has to be done by a Jew. It cannot be done by a non-Jew. And here the Rambam gives us an exception to all of this, which is that the mezuzah does not have to be made, the parchment for the mezuzah does not have to be made lishma, for the sake of a mezuzah. The commentaries explain the reason for that is that the mezuzah is something that goes on the house. It's kind of more removed from us, unlike the tefillin, which we wear on our body, or the Torah scroll, which we read from and we're engaged with. The mezuzah is something a little bit more distant. It doesn't have as strict a law, and that expresses itself in the fact that the parchment does not have to be made lishma for the sake of the mezuzah. Number 12, halacha l'Moshe miSinai. There is halacha from Moses, from Sinai, that you cannot write a Sefer Torah or a mezuzah without first ruling it, meaning making a line, not with ink, but with an impression of a line. And the very simple reason for that is so that you're writing straight and not up and down. Aval tefillin, but the tefillin do not have to be ruled. It's called sirtut in Hebrew. Sirtut is like scratch. V'shei mechupin. The reason why the tefillin don't have to be ruled is because they are covered. You don't see what's written in the tefillin. It gets all wrapped up, put in the leather box, and nobody ever sees it. So it's not as important that it's written in that straight line. Of course, it happens to be that it is done that way. It's just not required. Now here's another thing. When the sofer is writing, he needs to... So with tefillin and mezuzah, he can do it from his memory. He can do it from memory. Why? Because everybody knows these parshas by heart. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, V'Ahavta Eis, blah, 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 etc. But when it comes to the Torah scroll, it's forbidden to write even one letter without looking at an existing text. It's interesting. I was thinking about, well, what about the parts in the Torah that are the Shema, etc.? Can you write those? I don't know. Didn't get a chance to look. Number 13, right? So you don't want the scribe making a mistake based on memory. He's got to look at every single letter, one letter at a time, and do it correctly. And that kind of explains how we have Torahs from all over the world, from Yemen, from Europe, separated by thousands of years, and we have the exact same Torah. Number 13, Sefer Torah, Tefillin Mezuzah, Shiksav and Epikurdis, Yisarfu. We already learned a little bit about this back in towards the beginning of Rambam when we started this wonderful journey. And we learned about the sanctity of God's name. And we learned that it's not the letters alone that make it holy. It's who wrote it and with what intention. And so we see the same thing here with the Sefer Torah and the Tefillin and Mezuzahs, that if the person who wrote it is an epikoros, doesn't even translate over here, epikoros is a heretic, someone who doesn't believe in the holiness of the Torah, that Torah is not holy. Even though it's got God's name in it, it's got the Shema in it, it's got the Ten Commandments, it should be burned. It doesn't have any holiness to it. Now, there are others that they've written it. It's not a kosher Torah to use, but it still contains some holiness. You can't burn it. And so what do you do with it? You put it away. You put it in Shemus Yiganez. So what are those? So if it's written by a non-Jew, or it's written by a Jew who is a sinful Jew, he commits various sins, or he's a Jew who betrays other Jews to a powerful person, not a powerful person, but a bully, or the person is not obligated in tefillin. So for example, a woman, or a minor, or a servant, are ela pesulin. So all of these, if they any of these... people write a Torah scroll or a tefillin, those are not going to be kosher for use, but we don't know, they still contain holiness or may contain holiness, and therefore they are intoned, put in geniza. And how do we know this? Rambam tells us because the Torah says, you shall bind them upon your arm and you shall write them upon the mezuzah. So we juxtapose the verb, and you shall bind them, ukishartam, and the verb, uchesavtam, and you shall write them. And we derive through the analogy of the words, that whoever is obligated to tie the tefillin is an appropriate person to write the tefillin, to write the parchment, to write the letters of the parchment of the tefillin. Kol shemuzar lakshira u'mamid ba, if you have to be obligated to do the binding and believe in it, that qualifies you to be a writer. So that's why a woman, for example, would be disqualified, because women are not obligated in the mitzvah of putting on tefillin. Let's say you find holy writings in the hands of an apikoros, a heretic, which we said before, if he wrote it, you would burn it. But we don't know if he wrote it or not. We just find it's in his possession. You don't know who wrote it. Yigunzu, they should be entombed, because we don't know. If you find it in the hands of a non-Jew, it could be kosher, because probably it was written by a Jew and written in a kosher way. Now, we do not purchase Torah scrolls, tefillin, or mezuzahs from non-Jews above their normal price. Why? Because we don't want to encourage them to steal and then try to resell it to us. So if they know they're not going to get a very high price for it, that will disincentivize them from stealing it. Number 14, a Torah scroll, tefillin, and mezuzahs that were written on the hide of a non-kosher wild animal, or a non-kosher domesticated animal, or a non-kosher bird, or it was written on hides that were not processed, or if he wrote Sefer Torah tefillin on hides that were not processed for the sake of the mitzvah, those tefillin, Torah scrolls, are going to be not valid, not kosher. Number 15, and of course he left out mezuzah, because as we learned above, the mezuzah doesn't have that stricture. Number 15, somebody who writes a Sefer Torah, or tefillin, or mezuzah, and while he was writing it, he was not having intention for what he was doing. And he wrote one of God's names, which is known as Azkara, the mention of God's names, and he wrote it without the intention of them writing this now for the sake of the holiness of God's name, that invalidates the writing. Therefore, when a sofer, a scribe, is writing the name of God, even if the king of Israel, King David, or King Solomon, greets him, he should not respond. If he's in the middle of writing God's name, he should not respond, because he has to maintain his concentration and intention that he's writing for the holiness of God's name. Of course, the Rambam says a Jewish king, because in the case of a non-Jewish king, if you don't respond, that could be a risk to one's life. You're not required to do that, and that's why he mentions a Jewish king. Let's say he's writing two or three names of God consecutively, then he could interrupt between them. Like after he finishes the first one, he's allowed to respond to the king and then go to the next one. Where do you have God's name written consecutively, one after another? You have that in the Shema. Shema Yisrael, Hashem, Elokeinu, Hashem, Echad. So you have three names of God, one after another, in the Shema Yisrael. We have a great question in the chat, which is, what is the role of mikvah in all of this? It is customary to go to the mikvah, that the sofer goes to the mikvah before writing each day. And some have the custom that they're going to the mikvah every time before they write the name of God. So they're going multiple times to the mikvah. Excellent question. Okay, 16. When you dip your quill into the ink to write the name of God, don't start writing the first letter of the name of God after you've put your quill in the ink. Rather, you should start with your new pen with the last letter that precedes God's name. So Shema Yisrael, you should write the Lamed with your new ink before writing God's name. Why? Because the commentators explain, either you may have too much ink that you have on the quill, there might be a hair in there, so you don't want to be testing it out and experimenting with God's name. You want to do that on some other word, some other letter, make sure everything's working fine before you start writing God's name. if a person forgot to write the name, if the sofer forgot to write the name of God at all, and he's written the line, and this is with a Torah scroll, and he said, "Well, I missed God's name." He can put it above, between the lines, put it above the letters, above the lines. What makes Hashem Yishim is still possible, but you can't do part of the name in line and a little bit of it hanging outside. It's got to be even. But other words that are not God's name, you could do that. You could write part of it in line and part of it jumping up into between the lines. This is all true with the Sefer Torah, but with regarding a mezuzah and tefillin, you cannot hang even one letter. They all have to be in line. If you forgot even one letter, you can't go back and hang one in the middle there, because the reason for this is because the tefillin and mezuzahs have to be written in order. It cannot be written out of order. It must be written in the order that it is in the Torah. So if you're going to go back and add a word that you missed, or even a letter that you missed, it turns out that the tefillin and the mezuzah were not written, or that parsha was not written in the proper order. It's not kosher. But with the Torah scroll, if you wrote the whole Torah, you got to the end, you realize, oh, I forgot to write Bereishis. Don't worry, you can fill it in. You don't have to write the whole Torah again. Thank God for that law. If you missed even one letter with a mezuzah or a parsha of tefillin, you intone whatever you wrote. It's no good. Can't do anything with it. And you just start over from scratch. And it's permitted to write the name of God on a place that you had scratched off other ink, or you had rubbed out other ink. It's okay. It doesn't have to be on a fresh piece of parchment. Number 17. When the sofers are writing the Torah scrolls, the tefillin, the mezuzahs, they have to treat it with respect. They can't turn what they're writing, the parchment, over on its face to protect it. That's not respectful. Instead, in order to protect it, they should spread a cloth over it or fold it. And we have the same thing with our, you know, if you're reading a book that you took out of the library, or you bought at Barnes & Noble and you want to keep the place, you can, you know, put it on its face. But with a Torah book, with a chumash or a siddur, you're not supposed to do that. Hopefully it has one of those fancy things you hold your place, or you find a bookmark, but you're not supposed to put it on its face. It's not considered respectful, and we see that in this halacha here. Number 18, following rule applies when a scribe who wrote a Torah scroll to fill in his estates, I did not write the names of God with the proper intent. Once they have left his hand, once the scribe has already given you the materials, his statements are not believed with regard to the disqualification of the scroll. They are, however, accepted to the extent that he must forfeit his entire wage. Why isn't he believed with regard to the disqualification of the scroll? Because it's possible that he wanted to cause a loss to the purchaser or to the person who hired him, thinking that with this statement, all that he would be required to forfeit would be the payment for the names of God. So he's thinking, I got the money for... This is a difficult character, but I would recommend going to a different sofer, but we deal with all kinds of cases. He says, I didn't write the names of God properly. He is thinking that just disqualifies the names of God. He doesn't realize that disqualifies the entire thing. And therefore, he has disqualified the entire thing with his words, and therefore he's not going to be paid for it. But we don't believe him because we say that he was thinking that he's still going to get paid for all of it. Accordingly, were he to say that the parchment of this Torah scroll or tefillin was not processed with the proper intent in mind, and as we saw that invalidates the tefillin, his statements are accepted with regard to the disqualification of the sacred arrows, because by virtue of these statements, he forfeits his entire wage. So if he's willing to forfeit his entire wage, then he must be telling the truth, and it must be that these are not kosher. Because everyone knows that if the parchments were not processed with the proper intent, he does not deserve any payment. Okay. Number 19, the tefillin and the mezuzah must be written, it's a Torah scroll, we'll see in a second, must be written b'ksav, in the Assyrian script. That's basically the script that you see in a Torah scroll or in a mezuzah. V'itiru v'svarim lichtav afivani bilvad. With Torah scrolls, they said it's allowed to write in Greek language as well. However, says the Rambam, the Greek language has been forgotten from the world. It has been confused and sunk into oblivion. Therefore, at present, all three sacred articles may be written using Assyrian script alone, which is, again, the Ksav Ashuri. That's the script that you see in a mezuzah in a Torah scroll. One must be precise while writing them, making sure that one letter does not become attached to another. Because any letter which is not surrounded by parchment on all four sides is unacceptable. Any letter that cannot be read by a child who is neither wise nor foolish is not acceptable. Why neither wise nor foolish? Because if the child is wise, even if the letter is not written correctly, he's going to figure out what the letter is by context using his mind. Therefore, he's too wise. We want to know, what does a child think of this without looking at the context or anything like that? Also, you don't want to have a child who's too foolish because they might not see a letter that is acceptable and they might think they might not recognize it. Therefore, one must be careful with regard to the form of the letters so that a yud will not resemble a vav, because if you make a yud a little too long, it looks like a vav, nor a vav a yud. A kaf should not resemble a bet should not resemble a kaf, a dalet should not resemble a resh, nor a resh a dalet. And the same applies in other instances. It's got to be written in a way that a reader will be able to read without difficulty. Number 20, and this is the final halacha for today. If there is a hole in the parchment, one should not write over a hole. If, however, ink passes over the hole without seeping through, the presence of the hole is of no consequence, and one may write upon it. Accordingly, if the skin of a fowl has been processed, it is permissible to write upon it. Even though the skin of a fowl has lots of little holes, those holes are so small that it's fine. The following rules apply when a parchment becomes perforated after it has been written on. I've seen Torah scrolls where you'll see a hole in the parchment somewhere. So what's the deal? If the perforation is within the inside of a letter, for example, in the space inside a hay, inside a mem, which has a big, empty, no ink area, or inside any other letters, it is acceptable because it has not interfered or harmed the ink of the letter, despite the fact that a leg of a letter becomes perforated to the extent that it becomes separated. It is acceptable if the length of the leg is equivalent to that of a small letter, and B, the letter's present form does not resemble another letter. If the length of the leg is not equivalent to that of a small letter, it is not acceptable. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes chapter 1 of Tefillin, Mezuzah, and Torah. I'm going to look at some of the questions here. Let's jump to 3 and 4. May Tefillin be written on parchment made from the skin of a kosher animal that was not slaughtered properly? What do you vote?
Yes.
All right, we get a check. Should the parchment of a Torah scroll be ruled?
Yes.
It doesn't have to be, but one may use... Let me read the multiple choice. Maybe I can mix you up. It doesn't have to be, but one may use ruled parchment if he prefers that. Yes, it must be ruled. No, it may not be ruled. I think we said yes, it must be ruled. Good. Which one of them does not need to be ruled?
Tefillin.
Awesome. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I did say that I was going to share the other screen, which is here. This is a blog, apparently, by a sofer, Jewish music blogger turned sofer. And here's where he shows the picture of a Yemenite Gewil scroll, or Gewil, as we've seen. And as you can see, this is a much darker parchment. And you see over here, the Ashkenazi scroll, note the white cloth color. And so here's where he explains what I mentioned. Torah scrolls were always written in the Gewil, the outer part of a fully grown kosher animal skin, the outer part, sheep, goat, deer, and so on. That's how Moses, Aaron, the Rambam wrote their Sefer Torahs, etc. Around 700 BCE, the feather quill started to become immensely popular among scribes in general, and especially in Europe. And many sofrim started to favor these quills instead of the original reed quills. Okay, this is some error over here because BCE, nobody, I don't think there are any Jews in Europe. So maybe he means CE. The parchment was also improved. The European scribes started to write not on the outer, but on the inner part of the animal skin, which is called the cloth, because it was more smooth and suitable for delicate feather quills. Reed quills are more sturdy and can write in either gvil or cloth. Feather quills don't write well in gvil. This inner part of the animal skin is called cloth. Cloth means peeled, and maybe that has a connotation of smoothness as well. And eventually, all Ashkenazi scribes switched for this parchment, the feather quill altogether, for mezuzahs and Torah scrolls. The gvil went out of fashion, so to speak. The Ashkenazi rabbis accepted these changes. And as we saw in Rambam, Rambam said that these are kosher. He just said that ideally it should be written on the gvil, on the outer part of the animal's hide. All Ashkenazi Torah scrolls are written in cloth to this very day. But the Sephardi world was less influenced by these changes in Europe. And the Sephardi sofrim kept using reed quills and gvil parchment like the original Sefer Torah. However, the Sephardi Jews started to leave the Arab world. It seems they were influenced by the Ashkenazi way of writing, and they started using the cloth. Virtually all parchments in Israel are cloth, not gvil. But there's a Yemenite website pushing for the resurrection of the gvil parchment. The Yemenite Jews follow the Rambam's custom. The Rambam wrote his own Sefer Torah in gvil. And they claim that Rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu, the former Sephardic chief rabbi, who was not Yemenite, I think he was from, I don't remember, Iraq maybe, has a gvil Sefer Torah, so many Sephardim, etc. So it's easy to differentiate between a gvil Torah scroll and a cloth one. The gvil scroll is dark in the inside where the text is written and lighter in the reverse side, right? Because it's the outer part of the animal, so it'd be lighter on the inside. And the cloth scroll is the exact opposite, meaning it is lighter on what you're looking at and darker on the backside of the parchment. So, ladies and gentlemen, I will open it up to questions and or comments.
I have a comment. Earlier mentioned about the using fish skin, the problem with the smell. And I had a class with Rabbi Rezik today. We were talking about gelatin, how could we use gelatin made from fish? And there used to be a problem with the smell, but I guess they improved technology that now that fish can be used for gelatin or fish bones, and it's not a problem with the smell anymore.
Right.
There's been similar advances for using fish skin for.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about. So, yeah.
Also, I have one question. You mentioned that if one letter is left out, even near the end of the Torah, that you can't just go back and fix that. So you can't remove the section, put it, and just start over just from that section all the way to the end. You have to.
What Rambam said is that with the Torah scroll, you are allowed to go back and fix. Tefillin and the parshas of the Tefillin, which are four. So if you made a mistake in one of them, you don't have to rewrite all four. But each one has to be written in order, and the mezuzah has to be written all in order. If you missed a letter or a word, you can't go back.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Can you clarify, did the Rambam say Greek script or Greek language?
Greek language. Yeah. It's a
shocker. Why would that even be considered?
It's a shocker, right? Because God granted a certain beauty to that was expressed in the Greek language, and it's called Yaftel Okim Liefes. He talks about the three sons of Noah. It talks about God will dwell in Ba'ahale Shame, in the tents of shame of the Jews. But he says he ascribes beauty, aesthetic beauty, to the world of the Avan, of the Greeks. And therefore, they considered it, actually what it says there is that the sages had translated it to Greek, right? And so they were very happy with that translation, and it was very precise, and therefore they considered it kosher.
Okay.
I always understood that the Ramban was strongly influenced by the Greek, or by Aristotle, and also, of course, the Arabs. I mean, he wrote in Arabic, yet right. Someone else translated into Hebrew.
Exactly, that's very true. But the Rambam statement about the Torah being allowed to be written in Greek, that precedes Rambam. It's in the Mishnah. It's already in the Mishnah. So,
okay.
But that's a good point. The Rambam was a big fan of Aristotle. Aristo, as he called him.
One other question. I know that there are many, nowadays, there are many women who are, I don't know what's the feminine for sofer?
Soferet.
Soferet. So, who's buying their Torahs?
I'm guessing those would be like conservative and reform who don't follow the rabbinic tradition.
Rabbi, perhaps this will be discussed at another time. In reference to, there are some letters in the Torah and the Torah that are larger.
Yeah.
Some are smaller. We had in Pinkas, we had a break in one letter. Then there was a special formation. In hindsight is always 20/20, I guess, but how or why did some of those things, you know, I guess I struggle to try to understand how they came about and how to fathom what they mean, or do they have special meaning?
Well, it's an excellent question. Of course, these are very, very specific. And the Torah, I don't remember if Rambam talks about them. And, you know, if they're not done in the way that they should be done, if that invalidates the Torah, I don't remember. Hopefully we'll get to that. Certainly Rabbi Potash will know that. So I'll just share with you, you mentioned that we had some interesting ones in Parshas Pinchas this past Shabbat. So one of them was that when the daughters of Tzelafchad, when they came to Moses and said, you know, we want to have a portion in the land because we don't have any brothers and so forth, or a father should have a portion through us. So it says that Moses brought their case to God. And the word for their case is mishpatan, their mishpat. The nun at the end is there. And that nun is written very large, extra, extra large, nun. Commentators explain that the letter nun equals 50. Yeah, every letter has a numeric equivalent. The numeric equivalent of nun is 50. And it's the tradition is that there are 50 gates of wisdom, 50 levels of wisdom. And nun shari bina, the 50 gates of understanding. And what it says is that Moses had achieved the 49 gates of understanding. But this 50th one was beyond him. That he had to bring to God. This question was part of the 50th gate of wisdom, and that's why the nun, which equals 50, is writ large. Another very famous interpretation and story with the letters that are written in unusual sizes, either bigger or smaller, is in the Megillah. This is quite famous, that in the 10 sons of Haman, there's three letters that are written in an unusual size. And this is how it's been written for thousands of years. And if you look at those letters, they hint to, and they equal the year, the Jewish year, that corresponds to the year when there were 10 Nazis at the Nuremberg trials who were killed. And it's like, whoa. Very unusual, within the 10 sons of Haman, the listing in the Megillah, you have a hint in those unusual letters to the year that the 10 Nazis were killed. So that's just two examples of interesting sized letters. It's a very, I think there's a book by Rabbi Roskin where he goes through all of them and really delves into it. We have a book in our shul, which is a book for Torah readers to practice. It's called Tikkun Lakorim. It's a big green book with Hebrew and English. And that commentary there also addresses any unusual letter. So if you have a question, you can consult that book. But yeah, they're very deliberate and fascinating field of study in of Torah.
Yeah, thank you for taking the question and responding. It helps because there are instances where that presents itself, and then it's read, but it's not necessarily delved into at that particular moment, because you know it's in the middle of the parasha, and there are other conversations.
Exactly.
To be had.
That's a great point.
Thank you, sir.
Awesome. All right. Anybody else? Question? Comment? Going once. Going twice. All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been another wonderful session of Rambam. We started off with a bang. The 10 chapters, mastering the laws of Torahs, tefillin, and mezuzahs. We look forward to see you again tomorrow night. Same time. Same place, different chapter. Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.